Welcome back to Travel Bags with Anita and Friends. If you guys are just joining us, we have been highlighting two of our sister states. Olivia and I are talking about Tennessee and now South Carolina. We're focusing right now on Dr. Benjamin E. May's Historic Preservation Center, which is in Greenwood, South Carolina, and it highlights his birth home, the school that he attended. It's a really amazing and very educational and inspiring also place to visit.
And like you said earlier, you know, it was hard for him to kind of go against the grain at the time to pursue an education. So it must be really special to visit a place that honors his upbringing, his roots. And then you get to see how far he went, how much he achieved, and how much he contributed to education.
Exactly. And what an inspiration he must have been to so many people. And in particular, the young man attending Morehouse College, which is where he was president for about 27 years. So I have part two of my interview with the director of the museum there, Christopher Thomas. So I'd love to go ahead and share that because more great information, very inspiring.
You know, in schools, they teach our kids that the cotton gin made life easier for slaves. And in one way it did, but they don't really tell the fact that it also extended the drive for slavery and made America continue to participate in the illegal slave trade because the value of slaves were so great because they were trying to then farm the lower South, places like Alabama and Mississippi, and people don't realize that, you know, most of those people had virtually no slaves, even up in early as the 1910s. But with the invention of the cotton gin, it just sort of drove this mass for slavery, and it really affected this area because you had many people, because the value of slaves was so much that a slave owner would just sell them away, and people literally had to walk, you know, thousands of miles from here to, you know, the slave market in Montgomery and such, because they were being sold into the lower South to, you know, like Henry Hammond told the king that, you know, cotton is king down here, and so that was what life was like for them. And so even at Dr. Mays's birth, cotton was still an important cash commodity.
But what were the free rows? Did you say something about there were?
Yeah, they would assign a slave a row, and typically they would have a row in between. So you were principally responsible for picking the row you were assigned to, but you could also, as you went along, pick from this row in between. And so only the really, really proficient cotton pickers would bother to deal with that row because they needed to clear their own row off. And that's why I said that he and his brother were obviously very, very good field hands if they were able to pick from their row and the free row in the middle and pick, you know, over 400 pounds of cotton. That's a significant day of cotton picking. So,
So how long have you worked here?
Well, I've only been the director now for 5 months. I have been a volunteer here, though, for about 4 years. Lloyd Sarton, who was the previous curator / director, decided to retire last February, I think it was, February or March. And so they brought me on in the latter part of August.
And you said that you have a family connection to the Mays family.
I do. So my great-grandmother, had two children before she married my great-great-grandfather, Charlie Thomas, and those children were Blockers. And so Henry Blocker was the youngest of those two sons, and his grandson ended up marrying Mays' oldest sister, Susie, and that's who she had the majority of her children through. So that Blocker branch of the family is related to my family, so. So this is the Burn Spring School. It is not the school Dr. Mays attended, but it's identical to the school he attended. He attended a school called the Brick House School that was sort of wrongly named. It was a clapboard exterior like this. But he says in his autobiography and in a video that it was named that because of a very wealthy white planter who had a brick house that was next to the school. And so they called it the Brick House School. So what he attended, he came to this school at the age 5. And here you see a picture of his sister Susie. It's kind of in her old life. She was standing in front of this school, I believe in 1955. And she was the one that we don't know how Susie learned to read and write. And so she was the one that taught Dr. Mays how to read and write and his alphabet. And so when he came to the school, Dr. Mays was a rock star educationally. And so he and his teacher, Miss Waller, had a tremendous relationship. Dr. Mays even said in his autobiography that he had a crush on Mrs. Waller. And so, you know, he sat right in front of the room. And very, very early on, Dr. Mays was a very serious student. And so both here at school and at his church, Old Mount Zion, he says in his book, The Lord, the People Have Driven Me On, that it was the people that saw this great skill in him and this great talents in him that really pushed him. Even at church, having him do speeches, he talked about the first time he gave a sermon at church and people just went crazy, you know, because he was this young man with a tremendous amount of educational talents that you just didn't see existed in the Negroes of his time. But Dr. Mays came here and you know, really excelled as a student, so he stayed here until age 15. And at 15, he really had learned everything he could from this little one-room school environment. So his pastor, Pastor Marshall, encouraged his father to send him down to the state-sponsored school in McCormick were really more industrial type schools. They were really more to teach people to trade, not necessarily to create a PhD theologian. And so at that time, Reverend Marshall tried to get his father to send him down to the state-sponsored school at South Carolina State in Orangeburg. His father never quite understood Mays's drive for education. You know, Mays, like I said, he wasn't offended by the farm, but he did say that he used to go, he wanted something more out of life, and he used to go and tie his mule to a tree and go somewhere and pray that God would give him an opportunity to get an education. And so his dad just didn't really understand, any of this. And so him and his father had a heated argument about him wanting to go off to school. And again, we talked about, his dad lived in a sharecropper's world. And so his dad's life was consumed by, getting enough crop to meet the lease obligation every year so you don't get put off your land. And so his father and he had a heated exchange. His dad threw a $10 bill at him, and Dr. May said he picked it up and went down to college in South Carolina. And so while he was down there, he met his first wife, and so her name was Sadie Gray. And he said that Sadie was the kind of girl that could understand a boy like Mays, lured by a dream, driven to accomplish something in life. And the two of them dated all through that period, and he talked about that most of the young men and women that were down there weren't really serious students, that they were what he called the don't care boys, that they were just down there, he said, to party and flirt with the opposite sex. But he and Sadie had a tremendous relationship, but even once he left there and went to college, the two of them agreed not to marry until he finished college, and they actually wrote each other every day for 4 years of a college education, which most young people today wouldn't last four days, let alone 4 years. But so he goes down to College of South Carolina State, and while he's down there, he gets a job cleaning toilets at night for $3 an hour, and he says that it was nauseating work, but it helped send him through college. And so he and his father continued to have this struggle between him getting an education, because students that were in the sharecropping world only went to school 4 months of the year. They only went to school November, December, January, and February because it was too cold to be in the fields. And so his father expected Dr. Mays to go down to high school and to come back and continue to work in the fields. And so he had someone draft a letter to send to Ben and say, you need to come back because you've got to come back and work in the fields. And he wrote his father back and said, Dad, if I continued to come back to Greenwood, I'll never finish high school. Because keep in mind that Dr. Mays enters high school at 17 years of age. So most of us are, most young people are finishing high school at that time. And he's just going. And he said in his autobiography that he regretted those lost years of his life. He felt like he could have accomplished even more than he did had he not been so far behind. But his father gets this letter from Ben. He goes and has another letter drafted to him, and he threatens him and says that if you don't come back to Greenwood, I'm going to send the Greenwood sheriff after you to come pick you up. And he said in his autobiography that he was glad that his father didn't follow through on that promise, because if his father had and the sheriff had come after him, he would have been compelled to come back to Greenwood. And he and his dad had a sort of tumultuous relationship over this whole thing for a long time. And after his mother's death in 1934, Dr. Mays was then the dean of religion at Howard University. And his father came to live with he and his then second wife. And he said that they had a reconciliation at that time. And his father just told him, I never could have understood or foreseen, you becoming the president of at that time, probably, and maybe even since then, the greatest Mordecai Johnson put together the greatest group of African-American scholars at any one institution that probably has ever existed, that were at, Howard University at that time. And so, his father just could have never foreseen Ben Mays becoming what he became, just a giant in the world of education. But his father, of course, died the same year at his home at that time in the D.C. area. But this, all of his educational pursuits started right here in a little one-room schoolroom just like this.
Olivia, when I was attending Spelman, people still talked about Dr. Mays and his influence on Morehouse. And with Spelman and Morehouse being sister brother colleges and universities there, there was so much influence also, too, that he had on education just really in the Atlanta University Center, including Spelman, where I attended.
Right. And hopefully this site and this segment will help extend everyone's knowledge of this important figure.
I hope so, too. And I have photos that I'm going to put on the website, travelbagswithanita.com, so people can actually see what I saw, because it's really amazing how they have preserved the home and how they have created a replica of the school. It's just fascinating to see that. And for some people, it probably will be a little bit like going back in time, because you'll see some of the school desks and some of the things in the home that may remind you of, if not your home growing up, but maybe your grandparents or great-grandparents, if you were fortunate enough, to have great-grandparents to visit. So it's a really fascinating place to go and to see.
And a very fulfilling trip. You get great eating at Gentry, and then you get your history lesson too.
Absolutely, absolutely. So thanks for joining us today. You guys can check us out on social media, on Instagram at Anita and Friends, and of course on our website at travelbagswithanita.com. You guys join us again for more great information about travel. Bye-bye.
I'm building me a home.
I'm building me a home.
I'm building me a home.
I'm
soon decay.
It's gonna soon decay,
and my soul gotta have
and my soul gotta have somewhere to stay.